the mouth. Up in a road of a man and all. I'm seeing your world of places and things. Your poppers and peasants and princes. They hate it either thing I wrote you a song. About a funny old world that's coming along. Seems sick and it's hungry, it's tired and it's torn. Well, it looks like it's a dying and it's hardly been born.
Hello out there, ladies and gentlemen. This is Tim Benall with BenallofAmerica.com's Benall of America Audio Season 1. This week, it's November 12th, 2005. Our guest, Grant Cameron. He's one of the most esteemed researchers in the ufology field today. He's been in the field for 30 years. He started in 1975 as one of the principal investigators of the Charlie Red Star UFO flap of the mid-70s up in Canada along the border. From there, his investigation led to the story of Wilbur Smith, who was the head of the Canadian government's UFO research investigation Project Magnet. And he culminated with an in-depth investigation of U.S. presidents that's ongoing today at his website, www.presidentialufo.com. And he covers their relationship with the UFO secret, what they might have known, news stories. It's a wealth of information. He's held in tremendous regard by many in the ufology field. He's a serious researcher. So I'm really happy we had the chance to speak with him. This interview was conducted less than 2 weeks ago, folks. It was recorded on October 31st, 2005, Halloween night. Grant Cameron, Benall of America Audio, Season 1. Let's take it away. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of Benall of America Audio. I want to welcome my guest, Grant Cameron. He's a native Canadian. He's been in the UFO field since 1975, so 30 years. He's seen a lot, he's done a lot of research, and he's just been through the whole system here. And his website is the critically acclaimed presidentialufo.com. I can't speak highly enough about this website. It's got a wealth of information. And Grant Cameron's one of the most respected UFO researchers in the field. I saw him at X Conference 2, and I'm really happy we can bring him to the Benall of America audio listeners. So welcome, Grant Cameron, to Benall of America audio.
Yeah, thank you, Tim, and thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
Awesome. Well, let's start out with a little bit of your background, you know, how you got into the UFO field and that sort of thing, a little bio.
Okay, at the time when it happened, this would be May of 1975 when I got involved. I was a student at the University of Manitoba here in Canada, was working odd jobs, this sort of stuff, and spent a lot of our spare time just sort of driving around the city, you know, whatever, doing basically nothing. Fairly young at the time, and what was happening at the time is just on the American, on the North Dakota-Manitoba border, right along the U.S.-Canada border, there was a flap of sightings that was occurring, and later on we sort of put it together. There was Minot, North Dakota, which is a missile base where there was quite a few sightings, Loring Air Force Base in Maine, where there was reported from NORAD documents UFOs inside the weapons storage areas, at Malmstrom in Montana, and at the Michigan Air Force Base, I can't remember the name, right on the U.S. border. Yeah. But there was piles of sightings going on in Minnesota, North Dakota, and we had them. And it wasn't until the National Enquirer came up here and string the whole story together that I realized this was part of a major flap. And what happened was here we had what started in February of 1975, a large flap of sightings which occurred about 40 miles southwest of the city I live in, Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, at a town called Carmen, Manitoba.
Okay.
And this object was being seen almost nightly. It was so popular that they even gave it a name. It was called Charlie Red Star. When you saw it, it appeared to be almost like it was alive. It looked like a beating heart. It was pulsing, very, very bright. You couldn't really see the shape of it because it was very intense light, moving very, very slow, very, very close to the ground. It was close enough that you could actually, in a car, we spend a lot of time chasing this thing, that you can actually catch up on it. You can actually gain on this thing.
Huh.
And anyway, this would be in May of 1975. The sightings have been going on for quite a while. And in May, there had one of the TV stations from the big city, I'm in a city of about 700,000 people, had gone down and actually gotten a film of this thing jumping off the ground. They had this thing surrounded on the ground with a bunch of pilots, cars, and they brought out a film crew, and they managed to catch this thing as it jumped off the ground, which was a world-famous film. Gene Allan Hynek at the time said it was the best UFO film he'd ever seen, and they basically knew exactly where the object was. They had ground tracings of where this thing had been sitting because they saw it on the ground, and this camera is 8 miles away, so they, you know, could do all sorts of calculations. This thing had gone from 0 to 32,000 miles an hour in 3 frames of film. So it was a story that was building momentum. More and more people were seeing it. It was in the newspaper all the time. And I had known about the story. I really didn't have. I had sort of an interest in paranormal, in life after death, things like this.
Yeah.
But I can't ever think before May of 1975 ever having thought about UFOs or cared about it or anything. And I said to my friends, there's two of us, or three of us, and I said to the other two, I said, well, instead of driving around Winnipeg, why don't we go out and see what everybody's looking at? Because this thing kept being reported in the paper. We didn't go the first time. And then when this film was shot, I said, well, come on, let's go and see what everybody's looking at.
Yeah.
So we drove out to this town, which is, as I said, about 40 miles southwest of where I live. Small town, about 2,000 people. Middle of nowhere, really nothing around there. The closest town is 11 miles away, and that town was maybe 250 people. Really very sparsely populated area, flat as can be. Terrain is some of the flattest area in the world. Mm-hmm. And we were there for about an hour. We were driving around, drive into the town, drive out of the town, looking at stars, planets. I really didn't know much about astronomy. I saw something setting, which later I realized was the planet Venus, setting on the horizon. It looked kind of interesting, but I figured, well, I mean, if that's what everybody's looking at, this isn't such a great deal.
Yeah.
And I remember my friend, who I'm still very close friends with, said, well, we're going to drive back into town one more time. And this would be about, we got there about 11:30 at night. This would be 12:30. He said, we'll drive back into town one more time, and if we don't see anything, that'll be it. We're going home. This is a waste of time. And as we returned and we're driving into back into the town, we're about maybe a mile out of the town, and the object appeared coming from the left to the right, very, very low, bouncing. We called it like a bobber on a fishing line. If you have a fishing line with a bobber on it in the water, it's sort of moving. It wasn't flying in a straight line. It was sort of bouncing up and down, moving fairly slow, very intense, fairly close, maybe a mile down the road from us, right in front of the car. And as I've explained numerous times, I've lectured to numerous people, and I've always said there's different things in the world, whether you're talking religion or UFOs or whatever. There's believing and there's knowing. If you have not seen, if you have not experienced, you can only believe or disbelieve. But if you've seen it, you know. And from the minute I saw it, everybody in the car said the same thing. There was no sort of discussion of, well, is that what everybody's looking at? Because we had that question for the last hour. It was instantly everybody said, there it is. Everybody knew instantly this is what everybody was talking about. And my father was a pilot. My son's a pilot. It was the most dramatic thing I'd ever seen in my life. I'd never seen anything like it. There's no way you can say, oh, it's a plane, it's a star. It just didn't compare to anything I'd ever seen or have ever seen since.
Wow.
And we instantly all said, there it is. There it is. And it was like pandemonium. And I remember there was a set of school buses just on the right-hand side. We were going west into the town. So on the north side of the highway, there was a set of school buses where they parked the school buses for the town.
Yep.
And I remember it was very, very low, and I was going in behind the school buses. And my friend, we were trying to stop because we wanted to get out of the car to get past these school buses to see this thing as it flew off into the distance. And I remember the car was still moving and people getting out of the car while it was moving. It was that exciting.
Wow.
That people knew instantly this was something that we had to see. So I remember I went home and I told all my friends and relatives and everything. I said, this is the most magnificent thing you've ever seen. You got to see this. It'll just blow you away. And I was terribly excited. And I remember I managed to recruit a pile of my friends, and we went out 2 nights later. And we were looking for the airport. There was the major place where this thing was being seen was what was called Friendship Field, which is a very small airfield run by Bob Deamer, who was a world famous person here in that he rebuilt the first Japanese Zero. He spent a lot of time. He got this industry going of taking old warplanes and rebuilding them.
Okay.
And this would be back then. He had already built a Japanese Zero. He'd recovered it from the jungle in South America. It was the first Japanese Zero ever rebuilt. So he was kind of a famous guy, and he had this little field there, and he would repair people's planes and stuff would fly out of there, local farmers and stuff. And we were looking for his airport because he apparently had been seeing this more than anybody. He was actually taking people out on tours and this sort of stuff. So we were looking for the airport, and I remember we went west of town, and I really didn't know where the airport was. It's a small field, so they turn off the lights at night, and of course, we were standing right by the airport. We didn't even realize it. And I had all my friends there, and I remember we sat there for an hour, and my friend said, "Oh, Cameron, you're crazy. When's this thing coming?" And I said, "Oh, it's coming. Hang on. This is the most amazing thing you've ever seen in your life." And I remember when we started, there was 25 people there. The guy who was driving the first night was with me in a car. We'd taken three kids who were doing science fair projects, and we were standing there. And I remember there was a car with a courier car that did courier deliveries. And I remember there was four people in that car. And by the time an hour went by, my friends all said, "Ah, that's it. We've had enough of this nonsense. We're going back to Winnipeg." I said, hang on. "You've got to see this thing." They said, "No, we're hungry. We're going back to Winnipeg for pizza." So all my best friends and relatives in my life just took off, and they headed back, and like I was crazy and whatever. And I remember about 15 minutes later, it was almost the same time as it appeared the first night, a little bit later. And I remember the kids were sitting in the field. We were standing on the road just sort of looking west into it's completely flat, but there's a sort of a hilly area there, yeah, just on the west side. It's the only hills for hundreds of miles. And I remember we saw a flash. It was like a flash bulb. And I remember the kids were sitting in the field, and they said, "Is that it? Is that it?" And I looked, and there was a second flash, and it was completely in a different part of the sky. And it was like a flash cube, yeah, on the old cameras. And the kids were getting excited, and they were going, and I said, yeah, I think that's it. And there was only five of us, and there was four people in this courier car beside us. We were standing there, and I remember it was, it started to move around. It was bouncing in the field of vision, about 8 inches in the field of vision, which was massive. It was just bouncing around, and later on, I would interview people there, and some kids that I interviewed, very, very young kids whose parents were involved, I went and talked to them secretly when their parents weren't there, very young kids who were like 6, 7 years old, yeah, who had all seen this thing. They described this as the bouncing ping pong ball, and this is exactly what it looked like. It looked like a flash cube or a ping pong ball bouncing around in the sky, and huge, huge distances between them. And so this thing was flashing around, and I remember it was the same sort of thing as the first night. It was like everybody instantly knew this was something very unusual. And it was like a football game. There was people swearing, there was yelling and screaming. And I remember one of the guys in the courier car beside me had a camera with a telephoto on it. And it was when the motor drives first came out for 35 millimeter cameras. And I can just remember this guy with his motor drive was going, "Cut, click," and just literally shooting this camera as fast as he could shoot it.
Yeah.
And there was no questions. There was nobody saying, is that it, or is this a UFO or whatever. Everybody instantly knew. And I remember there was a girl in the car beside us, and because this thing was bouncing around, it was just a flash. She couldn't see it. And she was crying. And I remember she saying, I can't see it. Someone show me. And everybody just totally ignored her. And she was crying. And as this thing came closer, the amount that it was bouncing decreased. And as it got closer, it was coming right at us. We were sitting there, and then it suddenly reappeared like it had the first night. It turned into this sort of a real bright red pulsing light, and it was coming right at us.
Oh,
this time it came fairly close. I would say it was maybe a half a mile out away from us, and it was very, very low. I'd say 500 feet off the ground, maybe 1,000 at the most. And came right at us about half a mile away, and then it made a turn, and it started to go towards the north side of town as it was going to fly around the north side of the town. And on the back side, you could see a green glow on the back side of this intense red object that people said, what was the size? I don't know, size of a DC-3. Who knows? I mean, it's very hard at night to tell,
yeah,
what the size was.
Yeah.
But it was dramatic, and I remember there was people yelling and screaming, and then as it made the turn, people realized that this thing was now moving away from us. It was starting to go around this side of town, and these people started, the people in the car, and I tried to track them down later. I managed to get to the courier company, but I didn't go back for a number of months to try to get these photographs.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to the people at the courier company. They said, yeah, they remember the girl who was a courier there who had been talking about this, but they couldn't remember who she was, and she'd quit and this sort of stuff. And I remember, yeah, they jumped in their car, and they said, we're going after this thing. And I remember the gravel was flying. It was a gravel road. There was gravel flying, and they took off chasing this thing.
Oh, boy.
Which is something that we did over the next – this flap lasted for about 18 months till the fall of 1976. And I remember numerous times chasing this thing with a car, and actually gaining ground on it. I remember you might not know what mile roads are, but mile roads are, if you see the terrain, there's every mile, there's a road. And every mile north, every mile south, every mile east, every mile. So it gives you this checkerboard pattern.
Yeah.
So we would know exactly if we were looking at something, how many miles it was over, depending how many mile roads we'd gone. And because the world is round every 10 miles or 12 miles, I don't know what it is, they actually move the road over 50 feet to align for the curvature of the Earth.
Yeah.
And I remember one time we were zipping along there going 65, 70 miles an hour without lights on. And because the road goes straight, you don't have to worry about anything. And just enough, you have your park lights just enough so you can sort of see to stay out of the ditch. And I remember driving right off the end of this mile road, they just moved the road over 50 feet. But we were so intense watching this object, and we're actually gaining ground on it, and suddenly we were up in the air, and we ended up in the field. Luckily, there was a bunch of snow on the field, and managed to push the car back out. So that's how I started, and it was sort of an experience where I guess I saw the big one. My memory sort of fades me how many times. It was quite a few, one dozen, two dozen times.
Oh, wow.
And then in 1976, these small objects started to appear on the ground that we noticed about 11 miles away from Carmen, and I photographed those. I took out, I'd say, about 110 people on various tours to show them these objects and how they would react to flashlights and to light and stuff like this.
Yeah.
Had some very dramatic experience. And then sort of just because the big ones weren't flying around anymore, I just sort of lost interest. People wanted to see the ones on the ground, and I would draw a little map and say, here's where you go down this road, you go down this road, down this back diluted, sort of secluded road, and stand there and watch for an hour or two, and you'll see this object flaring up, going down, all this sort of stuff. And I sort of just sort of lost interest in it because what happened was I had done a manuscript. And I remember trying to put the manuscript around, and it was a fairly prominent story. There was a lot of very prominent people involved. There had been some photographs. I'd bought up all the best photographs that had been taken there, and I'd had a lot of experiences. I had had so many interviews. I'd gone around interviewing people, and a lot of people, even though half the town claimed to have seen this thing, or in the high school, I did a lecture in the high school, and 62% of the kids in the high school claimed to have seen this object.
Oh, wow.
So it was a very popular type of thing, and it was a local story, and I remember going to the major Canadian publishers, and a lot of them did a reading of it, and you sort of got close, but nobody really wanted to take the manuscript. But I remember going to the local publisher, and the local publisher here in the big city here basically said, well, you may believe in this kind of stuff, count me among the unbelievers, which was my rejection letter. So I sort of got sort of discouraged that even though it was a fantastic story, I sort of came to the conclusion that UFO sightings, even though they were dramatic, even though they are something that really will give you an example of knowing that something's going on rather than just believing or disbelieving it, you have to see it for yourself. But I figured UFO sightings really wasn't getting us anywhere because I had all my friends and relatives, my father was a pilot, and even my father had some, you know, questions about, you know, whether I was really seeing what I was seeing and stuff.
Yeah.
So I sort of figured there had to be a better way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was one of the people who had sightings there was a radar technician who had worked with my father at the Department of Transport in Winnipeg. And he was a radar tech, and he had seen a sighting, and it was nothing major. It was the same sort of thing, the red object flying around. So I was getting these details from him, and he said his name was Ernie. And so Ernie says to me, he says, well, I'll tell you, he says, you know, if you really want to know about this UFO stuff, you should research Wilbur Smith, who used to run the Canadian government UFO program.
Okay.
And he said, I used to work with him. And I said, he was a real crazy guy. He said, I mean, he used to talk to the aliens all the time. He used to land in his backyard. And I said, what? And he said, yeah. He said, and he was serious. He was dead serious. And he was the guy that ran the Canadian government UFO program. So basically, I got the information, and I contacted his wife. And Wilbur Smith had died in 1962, and this was now 1977, 78, somewhere in that period.
Okay.
And so he'd been dead, but I made contact with his wife, who lived in Ottawa, Canada, and Ottawa is about 1,500 miles from me. And I said, I'm very interested in the research of your husband and what he did for the Canadian government and this sort of stuff. And she wrote me back, and she said, you're welcome to come down. I said, well, I'd like to come to Ottawa. I'd like to interview you. So she said, fine. And so she was impressed that this young 23-year-old kid was interested in her husband's work and was willing to fly to Ottawa. And then she also gave me a name of a fellow who I believe may still be alive, who lived in my area, who had worked with Wilbur Smith. And he was a metallurgist. He had worked on the metal that Wilbur Smith had handled from the U.S. military. And he lived in my area, and he had never been interviewed by anybody. He was very paranoid about the situation. He believed that UFOs had destroyed his career with the Canadian government. He was a military scientist.
Yeah.
And she put me in contact with him and basically told this guy, his name was Art, his first name was Art. She said to Art, this young gentleman is very interested in this, and I want you to talk to this guy. So
oh,
he had
wow.
no choice. He had to talk to me. So I went down and I interviewed him a number of times. It was a very scary type of situation. He was very, very direct. He was made very aware that he didn't want to be talking about this, that he would answer my questions, but some questions he wouldn't answer. And his children weren't allowed to be in the room. The wife was not allowed to be in the room. They had to leave the room whenever we talked. So I interviewed him, and then I went to Ottawa. And, of course, I was very interested in the stories about Wilbur Smith talking with the aliens and having them land in his backyard and stuff. And I remember I picked up his wife, and she said Merle was his wife's name.
Yep.
She was fairly old at the time. She had just retired from as secretary to the Speaker of the Senate in the
oh, wow.
In the Canadian Parliament. So she was a fairly prominent woman herself.
Yeah.
Had her own reputation to protect. And she was very upset about the fact that the Canadian government was, the French was taking over the government, that the French was being more and more part of the government, and there was sort of a disagreement there. So
yeah.
She was ready to talk. She was very upset with how her husband had been dealt with by the Canadian government. It was upset about this French issue in Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
So she, it was only a couple of days before she retired, so she was willing to talk, and I just happened to hit her at the right time.
Yeah.
And I remember picking her up, and she said, well, we're going to go to Jim's house, which is her oldest son, Wilbur Smith, the Canadian investigator who ran the Project Magnet, which is the Canadian UFO study, had two sons. Both one was taught music at school. This was the guy we went to, and the other was an engineer who has never really talked about it. The daughter has really never really talked about it. But the son was in charge of, the oldest son, James, was in charge of the files, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But anyway, she said, we're going to go over to James' house, and I said, okay, fine. I'd rented a car, and we jumped in the car, and she started, I drove, and as I drove, she started to talk about some of the stuff that had been going on back in 1952, 1962, when her husband died. And basically it was like a science fiction. It was unbelievable. She was talking about AFA, and AFA was the alien that Wilbur Smith had been talking to. And she basically talked about AFA this and AFA that, and it was
oh,
like,
wow.
This was for real. I mean, this was actually going on, that there was this alien and they had been in contact and this sort of stuff. And so when the interview went on, I didn't tape it or anything like that, but I discussed all this with her. And she made a number of very revealing statements. The fact that they had made contact with aliens. The Canadian Prime Minister had been involved, and that Wilbur Smith was dealing directly with the Canadian Prime Minister, and that he had done an interim report on Project Magnet, which had gone to the Prime Minister, had sat on the Prime Minister's desk for 3 months, and this was an interim report where he said basically this was for real, this was all a real phenomena, that this is what he had established from his investigation after talking to the Americans, and that it had sat on the Prime Minister's desk for 3 months, and that the Prime Minister and Wilbur Smith had gotten together and had decided that it really, and this was, I guess, from 1953 when this interim report came out, had suddenly decided that this was not the proper time to release the study. So it did remain classified until 1979, or remained classified for a number of years.
Let me just jump in for a second. Did Wilbur Smith's wife, was he upset that they decided not to release it, or was that his opinion too at the time?
He had agreed to this. He was very upset. As she told me, he was very upset about how he'd been dealt with by the Canadian government. She stated things like, for example, he had 37 different patents.
Oh, boy.
And that only one of the patents they'd ever gotten rights to, that the Canadian government had decided that anything that he worked on, and he'd worked on a lot of, he was an electronic engineer, and he was head of the radio regulations for the Department of Transport. He had developed a bunch of radio equipment that had been used in Department of Transport planes, and these are planes that fly up into the Arctic and do government work and this sort of stuff. And she had said that what it would go on is he would get a schematic, he would draw whatever the equipment was on his own time, and that the government would literally walk into the house, take the equipment and walk out, and maintain that anything that he did was being done on government time, and therefore they had rights to it. And she said at one point they managed to secretly patent one of the patents, and they bought a car with it, with the money that they made on it, and the government is very upset. They're only one of these 37 patents, which leads to an interesting story that Wilbur Smith, near the end of his life, as according to his wife, had developed an experiment, which is now being done by the Finnish and by NASA. This is an experiment and a gravity control, not an anti-gravity, but a gravity control experiment, where Wilbur Smith, his concept, which now the Finnish and NASA are working on, is to use a magnetic field, to spin a magnetic field at very high revolutions. And Wilbur Smith was spinning his plate in a plate with ceramic magnets glued onto this brass plate, and they would spin this thing. They were using a vacuum cleaner motor and a washing machine motor, and they would spin this thing at up to 17,000 or 18,000 revolutions a minute, at very high revolutions, and they would weigh this thing on a very delicate balance and would see whether a spinning magnetic field would lose weight, and they concluded that it did. Now, as I said, the Finnish are working on it, and most of Wilbur Smith's books were sold in Finland by somebody there, and NASA is working on a similar sort of experiment using a magnetic field spinning at a very high rate. And anyway, he had worked on this experiment and actually had gotten, according to the stories that were told to me by the metallurgists and by Wilbur Smith, had actually gotten input from the aliens, from this AFA, on how to build this experiment. And they even told a story, a bizarre story that was told in Ottawa, about how they were working on this thing. They had it in the garage, and there was a group of inside government people. One was from the Navy, one was from the Air Force. This metallurgist guy was from the Defense Research Board, where they did the weapon research. He was working on all sorts of weapon research stuff. And they would meet sort of secretly, semi-secretly, and they would work on this experiment. And they were working on it one Saturday morning, and they would get different weird things happen. And the one was they were going to test this thing moving at whatever 17,000-18,000 revolutions, and they got a phone call from a blind telex operator who was one of the people who was passing messages from AFA.
Yeah.
And this blind telex operator working in Ottawa said, "I have a message from AFA." AFA said, "Shield the experiment." So according to, and I've heard the story from two different sources, that this actually happened. Wilbur Smith said, AFA's told us to shield the experiment, shut her down, and they built a brick wall around this experiment.
Wow.
And they plugged it in to test it, and the thing exploded. And Wilbur Smith, even in his writings, which were recovered, said that they were picking ceramic magnets out of the wall, that somebody would have been seriously injured if they hadn't built this wall. So this is the kind of stuff that was going on, just bizarre stuff that had to be backed up. They had a woman in the United States that later on, when I did all the research, had been studied by the CIA, by the FBI, by the U.S. Air Force.
Mrs. Frances Swan.
Frances Swan out of Maine, that lived down the road from Betty Hill. And the stories that went on there about the contacts and what the material that she was providing to Wilbur Smith, and then some of the indirect stuff, like the fact that she had been brought in to talk to Betty Hill when Betty Hill was abducted by NICAP. The NICAP not only did not believe it, they figured this is totally crazy, that suddenly some woman's talking about little aliens. Aliens were always seen as blonde, good guys that come down to help us, you know, get past atomic weapons and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And suddenly here you have some woman coming out with a story that these little gray guys have stopped them on the road and abducted them and stuck stuff into them. And NICAP couldn't believe this. Keyhole couldn't believe the story. It just was not to be believed. And one of Wilbur Smith's friends, who was a NICAP member, Admiral Knowles, who was one of the top people in NICAP, had been very good friends with Frances Swan, and had actually taken Frances Swan to Betty Hill to try to calm Betty Hill down, to explain to her that this was nothing unusual. The difference was that Frances Swan was from the 50s. She was dealing with the contactees. She was dealing with the human-type aliens.
Yeah.
AFA was a human-type alien, looked like a regular-type person. And here was Mrs. Hill dealing with these grays. So when Betty Hill when Frances Swan was brought in, she basically said, "No, this woman's in contact with the evil ones, and I'm not going to deal with her." And it was very unusual, because this is going 1962, whenever it was, late 61, 62, and here you have the beginning of the Greys, who now some people would say are probably evil aliens. It sort of brought a whole new perspective, as if ufology goes through patterns. That it starts with the blondes, then it goes to the Greys, the abductions, and then you have, you know, it sort of moves on to different things, as if the aliens are sort of laying this out in a pattern, which is something that came out of the Frances Swan story. But anyway, the U.S. military, and everybody was looking at this Frances Swan, and this was one of Wilbur Smith's main contacts to AFA, this alien.
Okay.
And Wilbur Smith is probably most famous in the UFO community for having written the top secret memo, which was a memo that was written in November of 1950. And what happened was Wilbur Smith had read Frank Scully's book on the crash flying saucers, and he'd also read the book, the first book that had come out from Admiral or Major Kehoe, and had been very interested in the UFO thing, and had decided, as he said, there seemed to be a lot of smoke here, and he had a lot of contacts with the higher-ranking American officials, and he decided that when, once in Washington, he would, if there was all this smoke, he was going to look for the fire.
Yeah.
And he went down there. He did a number of interviews. One of the interviews that we know he did was with Dr. Robert Sarbacher, who was a military scientist down in the United States, who worked on various military things. He was sort of he'd go from one project to another and was sort of paid on whatever he was doing, this sort of stuff. He was very interested in being on the front line of research. So he was working there, and basically Wilbur Smith, they had a contact, and we don't know why the Americans were dealt with here, why it was Sarbacher who was interviewed by the Canadians, but the Canadians, it was the military attaché who set up this interview for Wilbur Smith with Dr. Robert Sarbacher, and we believe it might have been because Dr. Robert Sarbacher was working on the Dewline radar that it was being set up at the time in Canada to check for Russian missiles bombers coming over the North Pole. So Sarbacher worked on this and had some contact with the Canadians. The Canadian embassy, all this stuff was going through the Canadian embassy in Washington, D.C., and basically Sarbacher told Wilbur Smith a couple of things. He said, number one, the story's for real. He had been invited to a series of briefings. This is what he told Stanton Friedman when he was tracked down in the 1980s after we found out about this, that he'd been invited to a series of briefings that were held at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base dealing with a crash flying saucer that had crashed somewhere in the southwest.
Okay.
And he'd been taken, he didn't have time to go, but he heard various people coming back to the Navy office in Washington, D.C., where he was working, and these people were coming back to the Navy office, and they were talking about it. And he was connected with the Research and Development Board in the United States, which did all the military weapon research. It's now sort of like a section of the Department of Defense. But then it was a very, very big independent organization that worked on hydrogen bomb, worked on proximity fuse, all these different things were under this organization. And this is where all this material was coming from. And a lot of these people from this Research and Development Board had gone to Wright-Patterson to this meeting. So Smith comes back with this material that he got from Sarbacher, which included the fact it was the most highly classified secret in the United States, the UFO story. It was rated higher than the hydrogen bomb. And Wilbur Smith even stated something that which when people refer to this top secret memo, they always leave out, and that is the fact that he talked about mental phenomena. He said the Americans believe that mental phenomena is associated with the saucer phenomena, and they're not doing very well because they've asked us if we have anything on the subject, they're willing to cooperate with us.
Huh.
And so Wilbur Smith went off on this tangent that said that mental phenomena associated with flying saucers is very important, and a lot of what he did. So when people would come and say, I'm talking with aliens, they're coming to me in my mind or whatever, to him this was very important. And he always would take a look at these people, and what he would do is instead of just disregarding their story, he would take all the stories and put them together and try to find out whether they coincided with other stories. And that's how he determined in his mind who was telling the truth and wasn't telling the truth. He would cross-index all this stuff. And the other thing that he was told, or that he put in this top secret memo, was the fact that Vannevar Bush, and this is something that Sarbacher didn't tell him. People always assume that this Dr. Sarbacher told him. He got this from somebody else. And that was the fact that Dr. Vannevar Bush, who was considered the czar of technology during the World War II in the United States, very brilliant engineer, working out of Washington, was science advisor to President Roosevelt, and Vannevar Bush was heading the UFO program. There's a small group of people working on UFOs, and they were working under Vannevar Bush. And we do know that through the Canadian embassy, that a paper that Wilbur Smith had written for the Canadian government, and this is a paper that dealt with UFO propulsion or flying saucers. Wilbur Smith always called it flying saucers, never called it UFOs.
Yeah.
I think he knew well enough that the U.S. Air Force had developed a term to try to get people steered away from aliens and to talk about some nebulous term that could be meant to describe anything.
Yeah.
So Wilbur Smith never used UFOs. He always called them flying saucers, flying discs. He knew from the word go what these things were.
Yeah, they were identified to him.
yeah, later on we learned a story that was confirmed by his son when I went back to his son. And it was a story that one of his associates was indirectly telling. Then the fact was that he had been shown a crash flying saucer outside of Washington, D.C. We thought it may be Langley. We're not 100% sure. It was just an Air Force base out of Washington, D.C., and that he'd seen the body. And he had described to his son the fact that the bodies looked as described, and that would be Frank Scully's description, that they were human-like, they were smaller. He never described grays. At the time, people have to keep in mind that when Wilbur Smith was alive, up to 1962, there was no grays. There was no reports of grays. It didn't come until Betty and Barney Hill were abducted.
Yeah.
That's when it became popular in the literature. So it was always ordinary type people, and Wilbur Smith said that they could fit in to society, that he knew what they looked like, they looked like us, and he always described this. So this was an interesting document. It was the Canadian government, in the discussions I've had with high-ranking people, they've always said to me that Wilbur Smith misclassified the document. It shouldn't have been a top-secret document. He put top-secret on his own document and just put it, shouldn't have been top-secret. None of this occurred. And the problem with the argument that the Canadian government made, or these high-ranking people that we dealt with, like Milman and McNamara and people like this, was the fact that a document is always classified by the person who writes it. You don't send a top-secret document to the government and let them classify it, because it has to be classified from the minute it goes into the courier.
Yeah.
So he had every right to put top-secret on the document. It was downgraded the month after, 2 months after he wrote it, was downgraded to secret. But the Canadian government maintained the document as a secret document from January of 1951 all the way up to December of 1967, I can't remember the month, but there was a lot of pressure being put on the Canadian government to release the UFO files, and at that point they downgraded the thing to confidential, this document that they said shouldn't have been top secret or shouldn't have been classified to start with. They only downgraded it to confidential and wrote a memo and said at no time should this document be released to the public. If somebody had a real reason to read it, they could be, like inside the government, it could be released, but at no time should it be available to the public.
Oh, wow.
The document itself was not declassified until Stanton Friedman and a guy who actually changed his name to Mr. X out of Hamilton, Ontario, when they actually put tremendous pressure on the Canadian government to release the files. And that was in late 1978, 79, and Stanton Friedman got the first copy of the declassified document. So it remained classified in Canadian government files from November of 1950 all the way up to almost 1980. And it was a document that was top secret. It was written by a guy who had a very high security clearance. For example, his metallurgist told me that Wilbur Smith, not only did he have a high security clearance dealing with UFOs, he said, do you know what Wilbur Smith did for a living? And I said, well, he was a radio engineer. And he said, no, do you know what he actually did for a living? And I said, well, I don't know. I mean, what did he do? And he said, he ran Radio Ottawa. And he said, do you know what Radio Ottawa is? And I said, well, no, I don't. And he said, well, when the spies radio in, they have to go through something. And Wilbur Smith negotiated all the FM and all the AM frequency channels with the United States along the border. They would determine who has this frequency, who has that frequency. And he was in charge of 50,000 radio stations, whether it be civilian or military. And he also ran all the radio frequencies for spy agencies. So here was a guy who had access to all sorts of stuff. They had a station where Wilbur Smith built a flying saucer observatory. It was built at Shirley's Bay. And Shirley's Bay is about 10 miles, it was then 10 miles outside of Ottawa. Now it's much closer because the city's huge. But it was 10 miles out of the city, and it was where the Canadians picked off all the Russian communications. And they had big radio antennas, and they tried to pick off all what the Russians were doing. So he was in charge of this very highly secret establishment.
Oh, yeah.
And here he had a flying saucer observatory, which the government, as much as they hate to do it, actually had to admit that they actually allowed Wilbur Smith to have a flying saucer observatory. And this was on this property. It was on government property, and the building was provided for by the government. It was just a small shack, and on my website, so anybody wants to go there can actually look. The photographs are there of this flying saucer observatory, which was open from 1953 to 1954 when Project Magnet was shut down. Now, the government will say the reason Project Magnet was shut down was because nothing became of it. Wilbur Smith didn't get anywhere. There was no UFOs, so they shut the program down for, just to save money, and it was total waste of time. What actually happened is that the Flying Saucer Observatory, and Wilbur Smith had five different types of equipment in this Flying Saucer Observatory. They would be changing, change in noise, change in gravitational field, and they had all these five instruments set up. And they, this Ernie Epp, who was the radar tech, and this was his job at the time. He was a very young radio engineer, and he was working in this Flying Saucer Observatory, and part of their job was to change the tapes. They would run with these long tapes, and they would have to change the tapes, and they would have the little needles, and you would be able to determine whether something was going on. And on August the 8th of 1954, he described the fact that they were there and that everything went. They had an alarm system on there, and this was I can't remember what the day of the week it was, but the alarm system went off, and the needles were going right off the paper, and they were all excited. They ran out of the building. It was overcast, and they couldn't see what it was, but it definitely didn't resemble anything they'd ever picked up before. It was very dramatic.
Yeah.
And Wilbur Smith came out. Of course, he was very open, which was part of the reason it was shut down. He was very honest. He was very open about what was going on. And he was immediately inundated with the media, and he stated he made a mistake in stating, if this is not a mistake, if there's not a malfunctioning equipment, we've just detected the first flying saucer flying over Ottawa, Canada,
which
is the Canadian nation's capital. Didn't go over very well with the government.
They were
stuck in a situation where they were about to go on record as having detected a flying saucer over the nation's capital, determined at a building run by the government, with government employees on government property, and they just couldn't take it. And Wilbur Smith had already stated that he wasn't getting enough funding. There was problems. He'd written a memo earlier and stated that he either should be released to actually find out what was going on and be given the support, or the project should be shut down. So they already had this memo from Smith, and at that point they couldn't take the publicity, and basically what they did was to shut the program down, and they gave Wilbur Smith an agreement that he could, in exchange, use the government equipment as long as he no longer said that he was working for the government. He could say he was doing it on private time, and he was able to use this equipment and do whatever he wanted. So they ended up in a situation where they were able to sidestep the issue. And so if you see the Canadian government statements, they always say he did it in his spare time with equipment that was loaned to him by the Canadian government. And that's true, but it's only true after August the 10th, 1954, when they shut the program. Before then, they had two full-time engineers working on it. We have correspondence from the Canadian Embassy where Wilbur Smith said it is classified secret until we know further. It's an official government program. And in some of his correspondence, he did say quite clearly, this is the official government flying saucer program. It was shut down, and I was in charge of the program. So they can't say he was working for anybody. He was basically, according to his wife, he was working for the Prime Minister of Canada above everybody else, and it was shut down and basically taken out of the loop, but did still have a lot of his major contacts in the United States, and was able, at the end of his life, he was very disillusioned. For example, they wanted the schematic for the gravity control program, or the experiment that he was running. And he went to a Dr. Rose, according to his wife, and we know who this Rose was. He was a National Research Council, and Rose had said to him, well, you draw it all out, and we'll take a look at it, and we'll check your measurements and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Wilbur said, no, you can come to my house and you can look at it, but I'm not going to write it down. Because you're just going to come into my house and take the equipment.
Yeah.
And Rose said, well, no, then we can't really do anything with this. And his wife said he came home after that meeting with Dr. Rose at NRC, he was a physicist, and said he came home and he took the experiment apart, and he said, the world is not ready for this. All they would do is build bigger and better bombs with it. And she said he never said another thing. He lived another year, 2 years. He never said another thing about the experiment until he died. And what he did when he was close to death, he was dying of cancer of the lower bowel, he actually started to talk. This is when his son asked him about the bodies and about the craft, and he figured there was nothing he could do about him. He was no longer going to be affected by the Secrecy Act.
Yeah.
He told his son this story that he had actually seen the bodies and seen the craft. And he informed his wife that when he died, the government would be coming looking for his files, and that she should make an effort to hide the files, and that it didn't matter who came to look for the files, that she should not give the files over, that people would be coming looking for the files. So they made an effort, and what they did was they hid the files with the son. And I didn't know this until even I was at the son's house. I didn't even actually know this until years later where they had hidden the files. But the son, James Smith, had hidden the files. She said, sure enough, the minute Wilbur Smith died in late 1962, she said, the American government came, people representing the American government, people representing the Canadian government came, and people representing the Russian government came.
Oh, wow.
And they all asked for his files. And they wanted them for research purposes. And she had told all of them the same story. No, I destroyed the files. We don't have the files anymore. And she said at that point, the break-in started at the house. She said it was
very evident
that somebody was breaking into the house. The screen door would be cut into the house, but nothing would be touched in the house. And she said this occurred on a number of different occasions.
What
happened was the files went to the son, and then later on they went to a guy by the name of Arthur Bray, who was a guy who had the files, and who was a Navy guy, had a security clearance, had worked with the Canadian Navy, and he held the files for a number of years until, I can't remember what year he handed them over, but he had gotten on in life, had retired, and basically had written a couple of books, talked a little bit about Wilbur Smith, what was in the documents and stuff, what he had. And I would write him and I'd say, what did he talk about on this subject? And he would send me a document or two of what he had talked about. And whenever it was let's just say 1990,
yeah.
He decided that he would hand over the files, and he handed them over to the University of Ottawa, which is a French university in the nation's capital, and they archive all the documents. And I remember going there to look for these documents to finally see the Smith files.
Yeah.
They were all intact, that Wilbur Smith had made sure that he would recover, that they would survive his death, to actually tell the story of what actually happened. And I remember going there, and not much support from the archivist. They basically said, and here I'd come 1,500 miles to see these, and they said, well, you can't photocopy everything in the file. I said, why? She said, well, that's just the rule we have. I said, fine, okay, give me the file. And I went to the next room and photocopied everything, and I brought it back. And I gave me the next file, and I went back in and photocopied everything. And I basically stood there for hours, and I photocopied everything I could get out of those files.
Okay.
And I took them home. And then later on, they actually made an agreement with another researcher who's just working on the program right now to photocopy all of the material and put it on a disk. And I remember him saying to me, there was a couple of files that he had that I didn't have, whatever. And he said, well, you know, there's a restriction. You can't release this stuff. And I said, well, you tell the University of Ottawa, I've got all the files, and I'm putting them on a disk, and I'm going to release them to whoever wants to see them. And if they want to, they've got any problem with that, they can come and sue me or do whatever they want to do. You tell them I've got the files. And nothing ever occurred out of it, because I actually went to James Smith, and I said, James, what's going on? I mean, these files, your father made sure that they were hidden and that they would be received by UFO researchers, and your father knows I'm probably the main researcher who's worked on his files. And he said, I can't believe that they're doing this. This wasn't the agreement. They have no right to do this kind of stuff. And I don't know what happened, but they're still playing this little game that you're not allowed to photocopy everything in there. But these are thousands and thousands of pages of stuff, and basically it went through all the material, and basically you have very interesting stuff like Wilbur Smith corresponding with some of the key people in ufology in the 1950s, Adamski, all the major contactees of the early 1950s, Keyhoe, all these different people.
Oh, wow,
and
that's great.
Basically talking about what he's discovering and confirming a lot of stuff, the fact that the Americans had a crashed flying saucer. This is in writing. Wilbur Smith signed a letter that they had tons of hardware. And basically what I did is I took all Wilbur Smith's material, I put on a disc all the interviews I did, all the articles that he'd written. He used to have a newsletter that was with a flying saucer group that he ran in Ottawa. I put all that stuff, put everything I possibly could on a disc, so that you get in a situation in ufology a lot of times where people have good material and they keep it hidden thinking they're going to make $1 million with it.
Yeah.
And I basically put it all on one disc and said, anybody wants the material, it's on the disc, and you can go and look at the material. It may be a little time-consuming, because I have, you know, it's not filed exactly right. You have to sort of go through the same as I did, go through a 1,000 letters to find what you're looking for. But if you look through it, you'll run across a lot of very interesting stuff. And that was the Wilbur Smith story. Okay.
Okay. Wow.
So that's how it started.